Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com. Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Summer's here. Spruce up your bedroom for less with our sizzling summer sale offers at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannon with you today until 3 o'clock. I just wanted to say thank you to all our listeners who got in touch with us on the programme yesterday to pay their respects to Micheál Ó Mura Shuirtaigh. It was a really privilege, a real privilege to do that show yesterday. And we're still getting some calls and great stories in about Micheál Ó Mura Shuirtaigh and Tommy Gorman, of course, the other legend that we lost yesterday. And we will try and get to those before the end of the end of today's show. So do get in touch if you have anything else you want to add. There has so much been said about those two great men, but plenty more to be said, I think. Now, we were, as I say, in West Kerry for much of yesterday's programme. I want to go to North Kerry now and bring in James Stafford. James, good afternoon.
How are you, Katie?
James, you, I understand, have taken the very wise decision to move to the lovely town of Listowel.
That's correct, yeah.
You're not there that long?
No, we've been here 2 years now.
And you have a little girl now?
That's correct, yeah. Emily is her name.
Okay. So tell us then, what happened when you were out with Emily in the buggy last week?
We usually go for a walk every Saturday morning, and as we were walking up through the town there, I was just interacting with her a bit in the buggy, and we noticed that there was a couple of spikes that had been nailed to an expansion joint in the middle of the pavement there. They were roof truss brackets, and they were properly nailed into the ground, pointing up, and they were properly put there to inflict some damage or injury.
Okay, so, okay, stop, because you said a number of things there that I'm sure, unless you're some kind of a roads engineer or a housing engineer, you might. So you're strolling along with the stroller, and
yeah,
you see there's these spikes sticking up out of the footpath.
Nailed to the footpath, yeah, that's correct.
Nailed to the footpath, upright in a way that you would actually
upright.
Do your damage. Okay, and you say in the expansion, explain that to me.
So if you're looking at a pavement, you'll see where there's a lines going across it. Sometimes they'd have a white piece of plastic in them just along the pavement. You'd notice them.
Yes.
So that's what an expansion joint is.
It's to allow for expansion in hot weather, isn't that it? To stop cracking.
I gather so, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not actually a civils man, but I just know what they're called.
Okay, expansion joints. Okay. And in these joints, there was these studs. And you say they were brackets from roofing brackets, was it?
Yeah, they're called roof truss brackets. You'd see them in attics holding the structure together.
Yeah.
So there's like rectangular in shape, and they have a lot of spikes in them.
Right. And these were not in the attic. They were actually nailed down on a footpath.
To the pavement, yeah. That's correct.
And if you had even if you had pushed the buggy over them, you could have ended up with a puncture, right?
Of course, yeah. Well, like anything that would roll over them would get damaged, or like if it was a dog or even a child, like the spikes would go through the paw of the dog or the foot of the child. Like
I'm looking at a photograph of them here, and it's kind of hard to judge from the photo how long. So they're like on two strips. Was it two or three strips? Was it?
There was three strips nailed to the pavement,
and they were each what about? How long, how many inches on each of those strips?
Could be 3 or 4 inches wide.
Yeah, and lots and lots and lots of spikes coming out of each of those strips then.
Yeah.
And all of these...
They would.
Yeah. And so you obviously, they're not in the pavement now. You took them. How did you get them out?
I got a screwdriver and a hammer to them, and I dislodged them there and took them away with me.
I presume you didn't have a screwdriver and a hammer with you when you were out walking with Emily, did
no,
you?
No, no. No, so I went on, I took a photo of them straight away, and I put it onto the Listowel Do You Know page, just informing everyone to be careful if they were walking past it. And then I went straight up to the house and got the tools and came back down and removed them before anything happened.
Yeah, fair play to you, James. That's very civic-minded. Because as you say, I'm thinking, imagine if you were flying along on a bicycle and hit them.
Yeah, well, like that, you wouldn't realise what had happened. They were that small, that hard to see, that you could be a couple of 100 metres down the road before you realised both your tyres would be flat.
Would they go through shoes? Were they that high up off the pavement?
They might go through flip-flops or small children's shoes, but I doubt they'd go through a normal shoe, so...
God, even the idea, though, of going through a child's shoe, that is...
Exactly.
...very scary. And, well, to say it out loud, it seems like the most stupid question, but is there any legitimate reason why these might be nailed into a footpath?
No, not at all. As I say, this was probably someone who had a grudge. There's no reason for them to be anywhere near a pavement.
Yeah, and I'm thinking... Okay,
especially the way they were nailed into it.
So somebody put a bit of work into this.
Yes, absolutely.
Just tell us exactly where, and then I'm in the unusual position, as I probably know where this is. So where was this, where did you find them exactly in Listowel?
If you're heading out the N69 towards Tarbert, there's a roundabout called Tim Kennelly Roundabout, and they're on the pavement just there on the left. It's just beside the Greenway.
Oh, yes, exactly, yeah. So that is up, that's in Cardown, that is the part of the
exactly,
store, yeah.
Down
and yes, in case people are wondering, there is a roundabout named after a Kerry footballer in Listowel. That's the Tim Kennelly roundabout up there at the top of the town. Yes, and as you say, if you just come down a little bit further, that's the beginning of that greenway then that leads you on out over, you know, by the river and down out towards Abbey Field.
That's correct, yeah.
So you could have cyclists around there, coming down there.
Yeah, absolutely. And just people going up and down to the shops or anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's very busy, actually, because there's sure all the Ballygalloe, all those estates and all that are up. You know, there's a lot of residential areas all right around that.
Exactly. A lot of children as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an extraordinarily dangerous thing to do, for whatever reason was in somebody's head that would do that. I mean, it is actually quite sinister, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a horrible thing to just even think about, you know.
And they're the only ones we found. Is it? There's been no reports of any other such spikes around the town.
Yeah, so once I went out and removed them ones, I scanned out the area and had a good walk up and down to make sure that there was none. So there was none up on that side anyway, but like this person could be dropping them anywhere, you just wouldn't know. So hopefully there's none anyway, but...
Absolutely. We hope that's it. That's the finish of it. And I wonder, is it just Listowel? Is it something... that's, you know, popping up anywhere else. If there's anyone out there has come across anything at all like this, I would love to hear more about it and love to get to the bottom of it, because it is a very dangerous, very, very dangerous reason, you know, for whatever reason it's being done. It is, it's a very scary thing to come across. And I'm so lucky that you actually spotted it, James, and that it was spotted by somebody before it actually did hurt somebody. Or hurt a dog or a cat or a pet that might come along and, again, not know what they would be stepping on.
Now, I do know that they were there for over 24 hours as well, because my partner had noticed them the day before and didn't know what they were, just thought it was very strange and that they could be potentially dangerous. That was the end of it. It was just by chance that I saw them the next day when I spoke to her. She told me, like, that she did see them. So, you know, there's been no reports of any injuries or anything like that, which is great, but just shows that people don't see it. People aren't looking at the ground.
Sounds like it's a look of God, to be honest. We did get a statement here, a very brief statement from Kerry County Council. So they say they were made aware of the matter over the weekend, obviously after you reported it. And they say following inspection of the public path, they reported the matter to the Gardaí, who have inspected the area and are continuing to monitor the area. Kerry County Council staff will also monitor the area over the coming period. Have you had any contact with the guards, James?
I haven't myself, no. I just removed them and that was the end of it. I just let the locals know and left it there. I didn't really think that like there could be any more of an investigation into it, because there's no cameras in the area. The things were in bits. I don't know if you'd even get a fingerprint or anything off them. I just decided to get rid of them and be done with it.
Yeah, well, I think you might end up with a call from the guards if they are following.
I probably will now after this.
I was going to say, we might have outed you now as the person.
Well, it's nice that you're raising awareness about it.
Well, it is important, I think, because as you say, it might have ended up much more badly if you hadn't spotted them and removed them as quickly as you did. James, fair play to you. Are you enjoying your time in Listowel? What brings you to Listowel?
I'm a fibre broadband technician working down here, and I am absolutely enjoying it. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a lovely part of the country.
It is a gorgeous part of the country, and there's some lovely people in Listowel, James. I'm sure they made you feel very welcome.
Oh, since the first day we walked into the door, they have.
Yeah, yeah. No, you couldn't go to a nicer part of the country. James, thank you for that. Really appreciate it. And we'll see if anything else comes in about it. Keep your ear out, and we would love to hear if there's any more information on that, because that absolutely should not have happened. Thanks, James.
No problem. Thank you very much, Katie.
Take care. Now, I want to move on to something completely different. It is something complete. I'm just trying to see where this is. Sinead. Sinead, good afternoon. Oh, yes.
Hi,
I know.
Katie.
Sinead, how are you? I know exactly why I'm talking to you, actually. because we had a listener in touch talking about the filthy looks that they were getting for being out in the park and having their children in these harnesses that you can get now for to stop your kids running away. Mm-hmm. And you use these yourself, Sinead, do you?
Oh, yeah, from the get-go. So the minute, the first child started walking, it was the first thing I got. And so I use it regular. My mother-in-law, my parents-in-law, my father and my mother-in-law, they had one as well. I would have another one in the car. It's a bit like a shopping bag. You'd kind of have it anywhere because you just don't know when you might use it. And then the second child came along and I used it on him too, and it was a lifesaver.
Now, you do know people do have a bit of concern about them because they kind of think they, you know, I see, even if you look them up online, they're called reins or leashes, and you know, there's a sort of an indication that it might be something you'd put a pet on rather than a child.
Look, I mean, I have a golden retriever and I love walking, and so I wanted my children to walk. So I had a buggy, but I live in a town and I just want to get out and about and walk, and I wanted the kids to have the freedom. So I would often set out with the child on the dog leash and my dog on her leash. Sometimes they get mixed up and tangled, just like maybe two dogs. But people would sometimes give me the odd look, and I just say, well, you know, he needs to get out and walk, and I need to stretch my legs, and so does the dog. So.
And do your kids mind them at all?
No, they didn't mind them. Now, sometimes they would, just not want them because they wanted the freedom to literally run. But I had a little rucksack. So it was on their child's back. And it was actually kind of doubled up for me because I could put my keys in there and the doggy bags. And I would say, look, it's a really cool bag. You're helping me out. You're brilliant. You're so good. And then they kind of just forget about it.
You see, these are kind of, they've been around for a while, but it's kind of relatively recently that you see a fair few of them around.
Yeah.
And now when my kids were at that stage, the toddler stage, mine were twins. And I can tell you, there were many, many times when twins run in the opposite direction. And you would be thinking, what I need now is some sort of a lasso that I could sort out the situation. This is obviously the answer to that. Yeah. And particularly if you've got a few of them when they're at that stage. Yeah.
This is it. I mean, I had a 3-year-old, a 1-year-old and a dog. And I love walking. I love the freedom. And when, you know, you kind of mentioned that it may, you know, that someone might think it might restrict the child. I think the opposite, because the child on the harness, they can walk and they can, you know, explore things, and you're controlling a little bit of what they can do. If they're strapped to a buggy, then they can't walk around and explore and have fun and stuff. So I think it's the opposite. I think it gets them out and about, you know, gets them exercised, and it's pretty good.
Yeah, I do. It kind of depends, I think, because some of them look worse than others. I think I have been that judgy person looking and thinking, God, that doesn't look great now. The way that parent is kind of, you know, pulling up that child, you know, shortening the leash on the child. And I apologize to all the people out there that I might have judged over the years.
No, it's fine. I mean, look, I judge people too sometimes, because I might see maybe, you know, pals or people I know around the town that have their child strapped to the buggy, and they say, oh, you couldn't let him out. You couldn't let that child out. But I just think, would you not use the harness? It's really handy. And they say, oh, no, you couldn't, no. So maybe I might judge those people going, oh, that poor child isn't getting out and about and exercising.
Does a child, though, not have to learn to, you know, walk with you rather than have this tether thing going on? Is that not one of the life skills that you're supposed to be teaching your child from, you know,
well,
from the toddling stage?
It is. So from the very start, I suppose, you know, my child wants to explore and move. As they kind of got older, I would say, they need to stay beside me. And then they would say, can I take this off? I'd say, no, I'll just keep it on just in case because you're helping me with my keys. You're really good. Thank you. So as they kind of grew up, they were kind of walking beside me, but I did have the harness on. So as they grew up, they were kind of, you know, they were learning how to walk beside me. But at the beginning, it really was there for their safety and my sanity, to be honest.
Yeah. And let's face it, we don't really prioritise mother's sanity enough, I think, in many of these situations.
No, this is it. I mean, I think I sweated so many times, even last night. I mean, I have a four-year-old. I mean, he's four now. And oh, my God, the things he gets up to, it's just, you know, I still sweat.
Yeah, it is. It is a very, very, very busy time, yeah. Definitely. Up until, I think, four is kind of the magic age where they kind of start becoming somebody you can then start to reason with.
That's it. And I still get disapproving looks. I did get disapproving looks last night. We went to a mass in our local graveyard that we pray for the people that have passed away. And I took my children there. And he's a four-year-old. He's going to be jumping around and playing with stones. And the looks I was getting, I just smiled back and go, hello, how are you? And they don't long look away then.
Fair play to you, Sinead. Are you in a town or are out
in
the country?
I'm in a town. All I'm
right,
in a town
yeah.
in West Cork.
Well, I do think that's another big thing as well, because obviously everyone's absolute nightmare is traffic. And, you know, to have your children loose in any any way they might run off on you if there's any traffic or a possibility of traffic.
That's
That is a whole other layer of you know, trauma if you're a parent. So, yeah. So you're saying that's it, and you have absolutely no qualms whatsoever, and you'd recommend them to everyone.
They are the best thing, and you know, I would definitely recommend it. And if I could still use it on my 4-year old, I would, but he will not. He will not do it now. But no, they're brilliant, and it gives the child freedom and the parents a peace of mind.
Okay, you're a good ad for it, Sinead. Sinead, thanks so much. Appreciate
Thank
that.
You.
If anyone else has a view on that, we'd love to hear from you as well. But we'll take a break there.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And now I'm going to go to something completely different. And I'm delighted to say I am joined on the line by Siobhan. Siobhan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
I'm very well, Siobhan. And I'm really delighted to be talking to you. And thank you so much for joining us. I'll just give the listeners a little bit of a background of how we ended up talking to you. Because Claire Byrne, our colleague Claire, was speaking to Bishop Kevin Dorn of Elphin. He's the chair of Bishop's Council for Life last Monday. The Irish Catholic bishops issued a letter stating that their opposition to legislation resulting in the introduction of assisted suicide or euthanasia. So Bishop Kevin Dorn was on talking about that. You were listening to that conversation, Siobhan, and you texted in to Radio 1 about your husband. And I'll just read, if you don't mind, I'll read out the text that you sent in last Monday. It said, my husband was one of 49 people in Ireland with PSP, a brain disease, excuse me, a brain disease that is non-treatable worldwide. He had poor quality of life and was facing losing his sight, talk, walk and being peg fed. He took his life 8 weeks ago as he couldn't take any more. We need this end of life option. We could have been with him at the end had we humane laws. Now, Siobhan, can I just say we're very, very, very sorry. I mean, that's a very,
thank you,
very difficult time. And I really appreciate you talking to us. And I know you wanted to talk to us. I know we'll get on to the euthanasia legislation and all of that in a moment. But I know you really wanted to raise a bit of awareness about PSP, because I have to say it is a condition I had never heard of it, this disease, and you say few people have, and you want to just tell us a little bit about your husband and about this terrible disease that basically ended up taking his life. So, John.
My lovely John.
Your lovely John. Tell us about your lovely John first. What kind of a man was John?
I met John when I was 24. He was 30 years of age, so 6 years between us, which was always a point of great humour between us. We both had a love for traditional music, and that's where we met, at a trad session locally in a bar called Malachy's. I suppose I was struck by this 6'1" hunk. He was a good looking man. He was tanned, he was back from Australia, and I suppose as his good friend Eamon Murphy said in his eulogy, I mean, John was an independent thinker in life. He ploughed his own furrow, so to speak, metaphorically and physically, but he would have, when people were travelling, he left Ireland at 20 and he didn't go to the usual routes of London or over to the States. John would have gone to the far-flung lands of Asia. Mm-hmm. Australia, New Zealand, you know, he was a carpenter, great pride in his work. He would have worked in Germany, Russia, Denmark, you name it. You know, so we hit it off because I loved his sense of humour. He was, you know, people since he has passed, they called him a Shanachie. He was a great storyteller like his father Joe before him. Mm-hmm. Great interest in history, and I'm a history teacher. So there was so many things that bound us together, really.
He was a carpenter, but he was huge interest in books as well himself. He was a big reader.
Oh, my God. He was an avid reader of history in particular. I mean, Max Hastings was one of his go-to mm-hmm. authors. You know, just an avid reader of history. He was interested in the environment. He was interested in nature. I mean, where we are now, we have a site on his father's land, God rest him, Joe. And this place is just a legacy to John. It's planted with all kinds of different trees. He knew the name of every tree, every bird, every insect. You know, it's funny. So we met and we fell in love. And it was a 10-year courtship because I suppose he was working away out foreign. And we'd meet. We met in Asia. We met in Indonesia. We met in Germany. And we kept that relationship going. And that was back in the day, Katie, when you received letters. And I have a beautiful bundle of love letters upstairs tied to the ribbon, you know, which in years to come will be for my daughter, you know.
That is, yeah, but, that's the one thing we don't have anymore. That is, it's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
It is, and he had beautiful handwriting. And I suppose that was one of the tragedies of PSP. He lost the ability to write about 2 years ago, you know. Mm-hmm. But he had such a beautiful hand. And to see the stamps coming from Asia and from China, he would have taken the train from China to Russia. Like, that's the curious natured man he was, a good, healthy, handsome diva, is what he was. A rogue. John was a bit of a rogue, you know. People loved to meet him. He'd brighten your day to meet him, you know. And he introduced me, I suppose, to backpacking. When I finished my degree in college, you know, he brought me off to, you know, the Balkans. He went to Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Belarus with our little backpacks and had scary moments in Turkey and Greece, Romania. You know, we did a lot of travelling together. And so finally decided to settle down, you know.
Settle down. And you had a daughter.
Beautiful daughter, Ellie, the light of his life. You know, the light of his life. And John is such a healthy man. You know, we have our own polytunnel here, grow our own veg. In actual fact, and I know it was a struggle for him this year, and I know he planned to go, Katie, really. Mm-hmm. And his friends would say that to me. He planned it. But he went out and he put in the potatoes. I came home and he had the potatoes in. I couldn't believe it. 2 stone of them. He had the garlic in. But I think he wanted to provide for us before he left, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. He had the turf organised. I couldn't believe I came home from school one day and he said, I got the tank filled. And I said, why are you filling the tank like it's summertime? But you know, he was thinking ahead for us. There's no doubt about it.
When did he first realise there was something up, Siobhan?
I'm going to take it to 2020. He has two lovely sisters, and his beautiful sister Marlene died from cancer in 2020, and that knocked him back a lot, as it did all of us. Wonderful woman. And in her memory, in August of that year, we decided, myself, John and Ellie, we climbed Crowpatrick and we cycled the Mayo Greenway, and we spent 3 days up there in Brafey House. And then in September, and I mean, he was hale and hearty. We would be very food conscious and mind what we eat and that. He wasn't a drinker, wasn't a smoker, you know, so one of those healthy guys, you know. But mm-hmm. he brought my daughter Ellie, he had bought her a fishing rod and he wanted to take her fishing, so he fell crossing a wall into the local river and he ended up with a shoulder issue that he had to operate it on. And then a month later he ended up with an appendix removal, and it just all seemed to go pear-shaped after that. And we just noticed that he had severe, severe fatigue set in. You know, when he was in hospital, there was COVID, so, you know, he was on his own down there, couldn't visit him. What we noticed as well was this movement had slowed incredibly. If John dropped a napkin, it seemed to take them an hour to bend down to pick it up. He lost his writing ability. I would have to write whatever he wanted, you know, sent away.
So his eyes were
burning.
Yeah, but what were the doctors saying for these? I mean, for a man that was, fit.
The feeling is that he was depressed. And, you know, having known the man for the amount of years I knew him, for 35 years, you know, he knew he wasn't depressed. I knew he wasn't depressed. And we wouldn't accept that. But, you know, we trundled along for 2021. You're trying to find answers and get somebody. And I think that's what I always felt. I felt very alone in the medical world because I seemed to spend my time trying to find out myself what was wrong. And then eventually in January of 22, I just said that I wanted a neurologist for John. I requested it. And I think, you know, Katie, what's so important is that doctors need to listen to families and spouses. We live with people. We know their twists and turns, their moods, their this and that, you know. And I at times I felt I could have been listened to more, you know.
Yeah.
So I just went in a different direction of going to, and then that's another issue. You know, we had to wait 7 long months for neurologists, and in that time, as we now know, there was a lot going on.
Yeah.
You know, so it's we're paying health insurance all our lives. You know, my father before me paid all our health insurance over the years, and was still waiting for 8 months. You know,
to see that neurologist, and you did see the neurologist, and what was the initial thoughts?
The initial thoughts, and in fairness to her, the initial assessment, you know, she saw that his voice was weak, the blink was gone, he had excess saliva. You know, getting up from a seat, sitting down was problematic. John, from the day I met him, was 12 and a half stone, and John was 12 and a half stone in 2020, and suddenly we've got severe weight loss. So in fairness to her, she bit the bullet, said she wasn't quite sure, but let's put him on Parkinson's meds. And they had the initial, as one would expect, the initial dopamine hit one gets from it. That's understandable. So definitely his mood improved, his plasticity of his face improved. But then it wasn't doing anything else for all the other issues. So we went back for a second visit to her. She changed meds, and again, little improvement really. And he was getting, you know, Katie, I believe I started my grieving in 2022. People say to me, you know, Siobhan, you're so strong. I'm not. I've crumpled. I've been crying in bed for 2 years. I think I stopped crying about maybe 6 or 8 months ago because I think I cried so much it was cathartic. Yeah. And I'd worked it out in my head, as my daughter had. We talk about it now. She's has been pushed into adulthood fairly quickly, but she's a grounded girl anyway. But Ellie would say the same. She knew, you know, we were going in a certain direction with this, you know.
And you finally did get this diagnosis of PSP. Just tell, what is PSP exactly?
PSP, you know, he was so bad in December. Well, he was so bad by August 23. His brother came home from the States. Thankfully, they were so, so close. And, you know, Seamus said, you know, we've lost John. He said, and he was right. Because that Christmas, you know, and my daughter Ellie has a video I didn't realise she'd taken. She showed me last week of Christmas morning. And he was an old man that was barely moving. And cognitive impairment had set in and that. So eventually, I just, on the advice of a friend, Mary, she said to me, you know, why don't you just land up to A&E, go to A&E in Galway. So I had changed doctors at that point, and they gave me a letter, went up to Galway, and that was such a cathartic moment for us because we met the most wonderful neurologist, Dr. Elliman. And, you know, I've written to her since. She was our guardian angel, Sudanese woman, and within 48 hours she called me into an office and she just said, I'm so, so sorry. But your husband has a very, very rare brain disease called PSP. And what it is, it's a protein that masses in clumps on the brain. It's called TAU. It's T-A-U, but pronounced TAU. And it just leaves. So all the issues John had was that. And there is no, this is a neurodegenerative disease. There is no known cure worldwide for this. I didn't know about PSPA Ireland. You know, I found out about them about a month before, well, no, maybe 3 months before John passed, I got in contact with them. And they have a fantastic website, you know, because the problem with PSP, everybody gets diagnosed with Parkinson's because I firmly believe that neurologists don't know enough about PSP.
And sorry to stop you there. What does it actually stand for, the PSP?
It's progressive supranuclear palsy. Palsy means weakness. Progressive, obviously, is an end-of-life terminal. Supranuclear is the brain.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's it, progressive supranuclear palsy. And it's as you say, rare enough that even neurologists are not that
correct.
Familiar with it, in your experience anyway.
And ironically, the neurologist we were attending, who did her best, you know, and said herself she was bamboozled, you know, two doors down from her was a neurologist that actually did know about it. And that's the irony. I mean, my wish is, had I known now, if we knew 2 years ago John had PSP, his life would have been so different, because Dr. Elliman put in place, and you know, there is no cure, so we knew we were on borrowed time with John.
Yeah.
You know, but at least he had quality. John has had no quality of life for 3 years. John has had quality of life for 7 weeks through Dr. Elliman, because she put everything in place. She put a patch behind his ear that was changed every 24 or 48 hours. And that helped him with, because I used to have to do the Heimlich on him. I was curing his food. You know, with very scary moments here. My poor daughter had to witness that.
That is very traumatic.
This is quite an insidious disease, really. You know, he was let down by his body ultimately.
Yeah.
So it's atrophy of the brainstem, really, and an MRI will show it up. It can present in the shape of a hummingbird is the emblem for PSP. But it has been misdiagnosed as Parkinson's, and that's why, you know, you have to keep asking questions. You know, John, thankfully, from January to April, we were on weekly visits. And you know, I actually only retired this year from teaching. And I suppose John and I had plans on travelling extensively once, as he said, once you get the Dul Con, Siobhan, we're off. You know, the Dul Con of Airgead, you know.
Yes, indeed.
And life can change so quickly, Katie. But, I mean, at least she introduced us to dietitians. She introduced us to physio, to OT. He had voice lessons. You know, there's so much out there if you get the right diagnosis. So I would say to people, you know, if you're on Parkinson's meds, and I'm not a doctor, this is only from my experience and my daughter's experience and John's experience, you know, there are certain tests, simple tests. John could not look up or down, and that's integral to the whole diagnosis of PSP. He had no up and down, and I couldn't figure, why are his clothes getting destroyed by food? You know, why was he dropping things? So
that is something that, if you want to say, the thing that separates it from Parkinson's.
Correct. You have no up and down and you fall backwards.
Okay.
Parkinson's tend to fall forwards, they fall backwards.
Okay, there's two very clear things to look out for. Yeah.
And obviously your MRIs and that, obviously, and others, and CAT scans and that.
But those are two practical things. Siobhan, I'm just thinking now, as you say, you had your diagnosis then, and you, at least, as you say, you had that treatment and quality of life for those last weeks. But had you discussed where this would go and how this would end?
Yes, we had. And we had discussed it about a month before he passed. We had talked about Switzerland. You know, he would say to me, Siobhan, why did I get this? Because he was a good man. Mm-hmm. Good dad, a good husband, a good provider. He'd also, I suppose he had Googled it within an inch of its life, Katie, and he knew from, I suppose, the last visits we had in the last month of his life, you know, from talking to OTs, and to those medical professionals who were wonderful people. They were a godsend. I mean, I'm so relieved that we got an actual diagnosis.
Yeah.
This is hard for us, but to get a diagnosis, and I would not want to be on this radio show with you if it's the only reason I'm here is to help other people too. And you know, and I'll tell you one thing, Katie, that for John, Ellie and I, John had his band of brothers, and it's so important for men to have male friends, and he had such good 5 or 6 friends. It was 3 in particular, Eamon Murphy, Pat Inchy and John Skehan were his band of brothers. They brought him out every week, and even when John was dropping food and dribbling and salivating, when he was cognitively not following what they were saying, you know, he was loose at other times, you know, but you know, they were there every twist and turn. And during COVID, we have three houses that we would go every 3 weeks to. And we still, even though John has passed, we're still doing that. And friends are so, so important. I had my school friends. I play fiddle. I had my music friends. I suppose, you know, sometimes cares get forgotten, Katie. You know, yeah. I took part-time worker. I went on job share to kind of ease myself, not realizing John was going to be able to ease myself out of the tough profession the teaching is, you know, albeit that I love it so much. But as one gets older, it drains you. So, you know, and little did I realize I would be caring for John in that time. So my friends were so, so important, and John's friends. Then I was so lucky with a music festival that kind of distracted me, because as a carer, I was buying John's mood up. I was keeping my daughter going, and I was getting lost myself somewhat, you know. Lucky to have a very good sister that kept me. My sister Marie was my rock, you know.
I think carers will really identify with that up and down the country, Siobhan. You do, you lose yourself for sure when you're in the situation, because it's all about the person you're caring for at that point. He didn't tell you what was in his head about what he actually, as you say, you talked about Switzerland dying route, but you hadn't actually come to any conclusions on that talk.
You know what I think, Katie? I think he was testing the waters with me, because we always had these conversations when we're in the car, looking straight ahead and you know, not looking at each other. It's funny looking back on things. And we'd just been up at Amos that morning, we're coming home, and he just turned to me and he said, you know, I want to be buried with my mom and dad and his lovely sister Marilyn. And I said, fine. I was thinking to myself, Jesus, where do myself and Ellie fit into that? But, you know, I always said yes, because just keep it as simple as I could, you know. But he never returned to the Switzerland. But I knew, and, you know, his friends would say they knew, because John lived a life of great dignity. He did, a great dignity. He was a great neighbour to people. He'd be planting roses. I said there's a swathe of 60-year-old women out there who I met at the funeral saying, oh God, John was lovely, you know, that he gave me roses for my garden and he gave potatoes to somebody else. He was just that kind of a man, you know. But we had mentioned Switzerland, and he was very clever the way he did it, Katie, because, as I say, I had that three-day festival. It was an inaugural festival to commemorate my grandmother, who was a fiddler. And he was going to attend the opening night of that. And then his legs were very weak. And he said, Siobhan, do you mind if I don't? And I said, no, you've got to, whatever works for you, John. That was always the way. And he rang me three times a day. How's it going now? What's the best session? What are the numbers like? And I came home after 3 days and he met me out of the car. My sister was with me and he just gave me such a big hug and said, I'm so proud of you. And the same week, our daughter Ellie was finishing her final or her exams in Galway. And so I know he waited for the festival to be over. He waited for Ellie to be through her exams. And on that Saturday morning, ironically, I was going into Ennis. We did a few bits here. We stripped his bed. And I said, look, when I come back, I'll throw in the wash and chatted. And he was saying how well, he didn't feel well, he told me. And I would always say, you know, John, you've got to change your mindset a bit. Try and think positively, which was rubbish in hindsight. But try and keep him buoyed. And I said, I'm going to town for an hour. And he always was a gentleman. Ellie and I never had to open the gate here at this house. You drive out the drive and he had the gate open for you. Mm-hmm. And he waved. He didn't say about Ellie that morning. He waved. And I returned with beautiful hanging geraniums, because he loved the red geraniums that were in the baskets. And I came back into the house and he was always sitting in his lovely chair, always reading a book. And the chair was empty. And then I went out and I called. And I saw the dogs. We have lovely setters and Springer Spaniel, and they were out of the shed, and I went in, and there he was.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the sad thing, Katie. He died in the company of a few swallows' nests, and albeit that John marked the calendar every year with the arrival of the swallows and the arrival of the cuckoo, and he'd love to see the second brood coming. That was all John had near him in death. And my one wish is that we, you know, this bill that they want to bring through in the Oireachtas, this bill has a lot of safeguards in place. It is very definite in what it's seeking to do for those that are terminally ill, that are in the realm of 6 to 12 months left of life. Because if you think about it, you know, when you think about it realistically, and I've lost quite a few family members, extended family, to cancer. And at end of life care and cancer, as did my father, my two beautiful young cousins, they were administered a lethal dose, really, and they died with all of us around them. And that's my wish for people like John who are with the disease. There was not a known cure. They're doing research in Tala and in the matter on it. But as of now, worldwide, there is no cure for this disease. So he needs it to be helped in dying, you know?
Yeah, Siobhan, sorry, when you're saying that you're the lethal dose, you're saying that's the end-of-life palliative care.
Yeah, that's the way the morphine is introduced
towards the end. Yeah,
exactly.
And it's not... It's obviously not assisted dying, but it's the way that our palliative care helps to ease people into death as it stands. But you're saying that...
He should have had a choice. People should have a choice, really, is what I'm saying. You know, and even on that 2021 poll that you had there in Clare, Burns showed 74% in favour of it in Ireland. You know, you think about Katie, there's 100 wars raging in the world at any time. We've got the war in Gaza, Ukraine, Syria doesn't get enough of a mention. You know, and I see there's 500,000 people dying in Gaza, and we will, out of the goodness of our hearts, reach out and help them. Why aren't we helping these, out of the goodness of our heart, people that have no hope in life?
Yeah. Siobhan, I am so, so sorry for your loss. You've been through the most horrific years now, and then that to lose your beautiful husband like that in the end is the hardest thing. Will you stay with me, Siobhan, for a moment? Because I know the reason you actually are putting yourself out there and sharing all of this with our listeners is because you want to help people and to raise the awareness about PSP. And I have another caller on the line who is in the same position you are in now. She has the diagnosis. Will you stay with us and I'll bring in if I can. Frances, are you there with us?
Hi, Katie. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Siobhan. I'm sympathising. My heart is broken for you.
Frances, take a breath.
I am. I'm here.
It's your husband that has got this diagnosis, Frances.
Yes, the 3rd of June 2022.
Had he been sick for long at that point?
To be honest with you, they said it happened then. But to my knowledge, Sean had this symptoms, as they say, 12 years ago when he had his first spine operation. I still say it all the time. And then he had a couple of spine operations. And on before the 3rd of June, Sean crashed the car. We were at a traffic jam. He crashed the car. I said, Sean, what happened? He said, I couldn't see downwards. So I said, OK, Sean, this is going on far too long. We have to go to A&E. So I said, are you prepared to wait? We waited 14 hours. Anyway, then he was diagnosed by a gentleman there that he had PSP. So to my knowledge, I really do think this has started 12 years ago and his cognitive behaviour started about 2 years ago. They usually say if you have it 2 years, give yourself 3 years towards that. But that's when he was diagnosed the 3rd of June, 2022.
It seems, though, that at that point, at least, that there was somebody that did recognise it and knew it wasn't Parkinson's or other neurodegenerative diseases it could have been.
That's it, correct. But the main thing is we have to make awareness to the health professional workers and the member of public for quick referral diagnosis and services delays. That's what's happening. We waited 12 years, but at the end, we end up in the matter and say, look, this enough is enough. So literally, we need a referral diagnosis and service delays immediately, and especially in Limerick, Katie.
Oh, yeah.
They have no aware of it. They have to travel miles and miles and miles to see a neurologist. That's not acceptable.
No.
And may I also interject there? Sorry.
Siobhan, go on.
You know, it's also what I'm aware of. There's a massive cost factor here as well. You know, I wouldn't like to tell you what we've spent in 3 years. And not that money matters. We were in the privileged position of having the money to service every time you went in an office door. But there is it's a prohibitive as well, this ailment, you know.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And Frances, what's your life like now? Your husband's name is Sean, is it?
Sean, yes.
Yeah. So how is Sean now?
Sean is good. We're getting there. We go to speech therapy. And one thing I really would like to thank is Caroline from PSP Ireland. She's a massive support. If I need anything, she's just a phone call away. We came from holiday. Sean wasn't well, unfortunately, as Siobhan said, you fall backwards. Sean split his head open. And when we arrived to Ireland, we had to go to the Mater Hospital. And Sean had diagnosed with gastroenteritis, that he would have hiccups for 4 days constant. Literally 4 days. We went to the Mater, we were dismissed there. Horrible treatment. I was very unhappy. They gave him two kind of sachets to take on a drip, and he was discharged with hiccups, lying in the bed with the hiccups, constantly hiccups. He was dehydrated, told to go home, take this prescription. In 5 days, if this doesn't work, go and see your GP. I contacted Caroline immediately, and she said, that was James's hospital, and she says, go to the Mater immediately. You have to go because that will put pressure on his heart. We went there. They really looked after him very well. I can't complain. But my first experience with James was there 3 weeks ago was not nice.
Okay.
Not nice.
Okay, Francis.
So his feet went. His mobility went, obviously. But now we're back on top of things. We're going to Exwell Medics. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard of Exwell Medics. They're a great support team for people that have disability.
Yeah.
They're all over Ireland. They're an amazing team. We go to Exwell Medics, keep our exercise going, even though if you're on a wheelchair, wherever you end there, but they will look after you. It's so important to keep your mobility going.
Yeah, and the other thing I'm hearing from you, Frances, is the importance of getting that diagnosis and getting that support is
correct.
So important because it's
the delay.
Yeah, the delay is nothing that you want. Can you wait there? I want to bring in somebody who called in when they heard Siobhan was on, and they're a friend of Siobhan's, and I believe Siobhan's hairdresser, Anne. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Now, we all know that hairdressers are not just hairdressers. You are therapists, you're confessors. You have heard all of Siobhan. I'm sure you've been there through this whole long saga and this traumatic time she's been through.
Of course. I mean, when she comes into the salon, you know, that's one of my things is to help people. So, yes, I've listened to Siobhan and John's story, and Siobhan is just, and she'll get embarrassed now when I say it, but she is a wonderful, caring, kind woman. And I'm so proud of her that she is on the show today, speaking out on behalf of John, Ellie and herself and all her friends and family. It's very important. And I just want to talk to Siobhan there for a second. Siobhan, I lit the candle at 1:45 for you, 1:45. And I wish I was there with you just to give you a hug. And I know your strength has come from John. Thank you.
Anne, you're so good to call in and reassure Siobhan and tell us what we all knew just listening to Siobhan. We all know what kind of a person she is from that conversation I've just had with her. And what an incredible loss she has suffered from what she's told us about John.
Yes, I know.
But you know, John is. I come downstairs every day, and there's a photo of John, and I touch it, and I go to his chair, and I have a word with him. He's still here with us. John will never leave us.
That's it, isn't it? That's it.
I'm going to leave the show now because you don't need me, Siobhan. I love you, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Siobhan, thank you. Thank you so much. You spoke so beautifully. And Frances, the very, very best of luck to you. You're on a hard road there, but I'm sure and I hope you have a lot of support around you.
Thank you. We just take one day at a time, Katie. That's all we can do.
One day at a time, indeed. Thanks,
and
Frances.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you.
God
bless.
And thank you. Thank you for calling. And thank you, Siobhan. We'll take a break there.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And you're welcome back. And what an incredible woman Siobhan was there telling us that story about her great loss of John. Yesterday, we all got knocked for six. I mean, we got that news about Micheál Ómar Hertig just not too long before we went to air. And then just a minute before we finished yesterday's programme, we got that huge added shock, the huge shock to hear that our former colleague Tommy Gorman had also died yesterday. And I personally would have known Tommy for nearly 30 years, I think back to when I was a very young reporter covering politics in Northern Ireland. And he was always an incredibly supportive colleague, and I know right through organisations, news organisations across this country, there are reporters with emails from Tommy, urging them on, telling them what they've done right and done wrong, even the odd time. But he was such an incredible character and an incredible reporter and a really unique person. And we've been hearing lots of tributes to him on the news over the last 24 hours, and people have been contacting us too. And I just want to hear from one of those people now, and that's Amy. Amy, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Amy. So you obviously one of the big campaigns of Tommy's life. He was battling cancer for 30 years, and he was very public about this, and reached out to a lot of people. Tell us how you got in touch or how you came into contact with Tommy first.
Yeah, I have just known Tommy not that long now. I was diagnosed with the same cancer as Tommy last September 2023, neuroendocrine tumours. And at the time, I was 40 and had a 4-month-old baby and a 2-year-old little girl. So it was a huge bombshell for me and my family.
Yeah. Take your time there, Amy. I mean, you're going back to that place when you have, there's nothing worse, I think, when you have a child, you're looking into a child's eyes and thinking, am I going to be there for them?
Yeah. And honestly, that's what Tommy made a huge impact on me. And as he was diagnosed at a similar age to me, his eldest daughter was also a similar age to my two children, and he understood that. But I'll go back to the beginning. So I was diagnosed in at the Beacon Hospital in September of last year. And I was in the hospital for about a week getting tests, and then eventually got the diagnosis of neuroendocrine tumours, which is a slow-growing cancer. It's not curable, what I have, as was Tommy's, but it's manageable and it's treatable. So I came home, and after about a week of just honestly living in fear, my mom called me and said, Amy, I've just realized that Tommy Gorman has the same cancer as you have. And I remember where I was sitting exactly at that moment, and I just got off the phone as quickly as I could, and I Googled to try and find his contact details, because I had then read that, you know, I obviously knew who Tommy was. His voice was a staple in our home growing up, and I needed to hear from him. And so I made contact with his lovely colleague, a very kind lady called Edel in the journal. And Tommy's been writing for that startup the last 3 years.
Was that the Currency, was it?
The Currency. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah, the Currency. Edel at the Currency. And I contacted Edel, and Edel said, you know, she was very kind, and she said, I'm sure Tommy will get in contact with you, Amy. I'll pass along the message. So I thought, that's wonderful. I'll probably hear from him, you know, in the next few days or in a couple of weeks. Maybe I'll get an email from him. You know, I left my contact details, and I was sitting there, and about 25 minutes later, the phone rang, and I picked it up, and he said, hi, Amy, this is Tommy Gorman.
Wow.
So you can imagine how that felt, how he made me feel.
It was I imagine, to feel there's somebody in your corner. And, yeah. that person is Tommy Gorman.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, Katie, is that I'm not special. I'm not just the one person who he helped. I am one of hundreds of people. And the urgency in which he picked up the phone and called me tells you everything you need to know about Tommy Gorman. You know, he didn't know me from Adam. And so he said to me, Amy, everything is going to be okay. And I could hear his name being called in the background. He was about to go up on stage and MC for a huge big conference that he was at. And he said, I'm going to call you back in the afternoon. And he did. He called me back and he said, where do you live? Because I live in Sligo. And I told him I live close to Carnes School in Grange. And he said, I'll be there in 4 hours. So he drove from Dublin and then continued another 45 minutes past his house and landed at our front door at 9 o'clock that night. And he gave me the greatest hug and came in and had a cup of tea, which he didn't even touch because he was talking and telling me about his journey through it all and explaining to me how my journey might look like, what my journey might look like too, because I had no idea. All I could think about was getting sick and, you know, not seeing my children grow up. But he was there in front of me and he did it and he raised his two children and spent his time with his family and had an incredible career and did everything that he wanted to do. And he told me, it's not just possible for me to live, but it's possible for me to live and be happy. And whatever battles we face, we have to face them.
The whole point of Tommy was that he was living proof that it could be done and that he
That's
had done
exactly
it. That incredible attitude as well that he had, that you never ever got any sense from Tommy Gorman that he had any health issues at all.
He never wavered, Katie. He was stellar, you know. And he said to me that day, that evening, what can I do for you? Is there anything I can do for you? And I said, I want to see your doctor, Tommy. I want to see the best doctor. And the next day he texted me and he said, Amy, I've arranged that for you. And I'm going to drive you there. I'm going to drive you to Vincent's. And I said, not at all. You know, my partner, Heinrich, will drive. And he said, OK, well, I'll sit in the back seat and I'll support the two of you. And so we met him at Colooney Garage in Sligo and he left his car there. And this was at 6:30 in the morning he met us there. And after having a really busy week, and he got into the back of the car with us, and I was not in a good place, really. You know, I was really tired and worn out and full of fear. And he told me the most incredible stories. You know, he told me serious stories, important stories, but he also told me stories that made me laugh out loud. And his sense of fun and divilment was also a huge part of his personality. But he came to that appointment with me and he waited outside. And then...
And again, let's just remind people, you were a total stranger to him up to...
I had never spoken to Tommy, never spoken to him.
Incredible.
And we learned that we had so many things in common, you know, soccer and Sligo Rovers. And I was a big Paul McGrath fan all my life and he loved the stories that I had to tell about that. And he had so many stories to share with me. And we both realized that we lose our phones all the time, that we lose our keys all the time, that we park our cars in obscure places, you know, just he made me feel like I was just so special. But actually, you know, he did that for everybody he met. It's how he made you feel. That was what Tommy had. It was magic. And he was the special one. He is the special one. And, you know, all of the coverage in the media, I wanted to tell, you know, about political leaders. You know, you didn't have to be somebody. for Tommy to reach out and help you. You could be anybody. And that's his legacy. And he truly, he kept in contact with me every second week. And he had this knack of calling whenever I was having a wobble, you know, mm-hmm. and feeling a little bit down. But he brought me to the point where I thought, when I heard the news yesterday, I thought, I'm never going to be able to, you know, manage myself through this without him. But actually, he already gave me everything I needed.
Yeah.
He was a trailblazer. He is a trailblazer.
You had a Paul McGrath. You were talking about your Paul McGrath story.
Oh, God.
tell us what you told Tommy.
We were sharing stories, and Tommy was chatting, and I was asking him all about the Roy Keane story. And then Heinrich said to him, you know, Amy has a story about a soccer player as well. And he was all ears. So I told him about the story, and I was a huge Paul McGrath fan. I'm always told to land the plane on this story, by the way, so I'll do my best to get through it. So I was obsessed with Paul McGrath. I played soccer, and all I wanted to do was play like him. And it started to annoy me when the managers of Aston Villa, Brian Little at the time, wasn't picking him, and Mick McCarthy wasn't picking him for the Irish squad, and he was slowing down a bit, but still managed to perform on the pitch like nobody else. And I wanted Paul McGrath to know that we all still believed in him. So I wrote him a letter, and we happened to be going to the Coca-Cola Cup final in Wembley. I think it was 1994. And we were going to see Manchester United versus Aston Villa. And Paul was playing for Aston Villa at the time. And we were getting our tickets off one of the scouts for Aston Villa. So I handed my handwritten letter to give to him and asked him if he could give it to Paul McGrath. And in the meantime, I had gotten responses from Mick McCarthy and Brian Little apologising to 12-year-old me for not choosing the team that I would have been happy with. And, you know, all of this, I still have those letters. But anyway, the important one was Paul McGrath. I wanted him to know how important he was to all of us, the soccer fans. And my dad used to hide all the paper clippings, you know, of Paul going off and maybe not coming home until the next day and all those things. But I always found him. I always knew he had struggles. And so about a week later, we were at home and we were getting ready to go out on a Saturday evening, myself and my brother and sister and my mom and dad. And the phone rang, and my mom picked it up upstairs and my dad picked it up downstairs. And all I could hear was, Jesus Christ! And I ran down the stairs, and my dad handed me the phone, and he had tears in his eyes. And I picked it up, and he said, hi, Amy, this is Paul McGrath. And he told me that he'd read my letter a couple of times and that he'll keep it with him on days that he struggled with. And so he made, you know, I think I've told every Dublin taxi driver that story, or anyone who's willing to listen to a story. I think I've told him that story. But the reason I came on to tell Tommy's story was because all those years, I wanted everybody to know about Paul McGrath and the kind of person he is. And now I want everybody to know the type of person Tommy is, because that's the story that I'm going to tell from now on. And but again, it's not just me. It's hundreds of people in the... There's a cancer patient network that he set up, and the Centre of Excellence in St. Vincent's Hospital that he has supported and driven forward, and all of these things he does in the background and asks for no accolades. And he deserves, he deserves for everyone to talk about him and remember the type of person he is, because he was sensational.
Amy, that is, I could not have put it better. And I'm sure he thought you were sensational too.
I hope so.
I'm sure he did. Thank you so much for that, and the very, very
You're
best
welcome.
Of luck. You have a long road ahead yourself.
Thank you.
But as you say,
but
you,
I know I can do it now.
Yeah.
I know I can do it.
Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Katie. Thank you so much for letting me tell the story.
Thanks, Amy. Take care.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And again, another incredible caller there with Amy. Now, it feels like a whole other show ago, but at the top of today's programme, we were talking to Sinead about her two toddlers, and or her four-year-old and her toddler now, and the fact that she thought those harnesses that you can use on children to stop them running away were the best things in sliced pan, and she didn't care what dirty looks she was getting for using them. Anne, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you, Katie?
You are also a user of the baby harness.
I am indeed. I am indeed. On the instruction of my daughter, actually, I didn't decide to do it myself. She uses it herself when he's on the one of her little boys is on his balance bike.
Right. So this is your grandchild, then your grandson.
Yes, my grandson. Yes, he's three.
And do you have any qualms about it?
Absolutely none, because my knees don't work too well and I couldn't run to keep up with them. So it's the only way at least I have some control over where he goes. Now, he's not on a harness all the time. It's only when we're going through the town. We live in the town. He's ample opportunity to be off a harness on his little bike, and he loves it. But I couldn't. I wouldn't. It's like it's a safety thing for me. I couldn't. I'd have no control over him or the bike. Yeah. If I didn't have it on him.
Have you just the one grandchild or?
No, I have four grandsons. I have two daughters, so they've got two each. And so they're fantastic, ranging in age from 8 to 1. So, yeah.
So basically, we would never have had the. I'm trying to remember when these came in, because I do think when mine were small, I did see some people with them, but I kind of shied away from the idea of using them.
Yeah. No, and I would never have used one either with my girls. At that point, there would have been a little harness that went on them. It was sort of like something you would put in the pram. You know, I do remember strapping one of my girls into a harness and strapping the harness to the pram. Remember, they used to have little fixations at the bottom of the pram that you could strap the harness to so that they couldn't get out of the pram. But I would never have seen them like tied around them and used as a leash. Like
a leash, you see. You see, when you use words like leash, people do get a bit uncomfortable. And
well, I do have three dogs, so we do have leashes, lots of leashes in our house.
Right, okay, and thanks for that. And I'll just very quickly squeeze in Martha. Martha, good afternoon.
Hello there, Katie. How are you?
I only have a minute, Martha, for you. You used to get tied up long before they were popular or profitable.
Yeah, well, actually, it was my brother's, Katie.
Oh, right. Like, yeah.
Going back, actually, to the, as my family are circus people. But my mother had these three children harnessed, as she called it, in a little fence in front of her mobile home, and the circus was in front. But all the animals were actually loose, going around the field. And these people came along and they said how cruel it was to have children tied up and all that sort of thing. So she was very upset about that. But she said, would you rather have the horses, she said, kick them or the elephants trample on them? So they took off anyway. But it was just funny at the time. But, you know, and that's going back, Katie, actually to the 30s, I believe.
You said circus people. Which circus were your family attached to?
Well, my own family are Courtney Brothers, and they would be Vegas. And then my dad was the manager of the Great United Circus. That's Fawcett's famous circus today.
Oh, Fawcett's, wow, yeah, great.
Yeah, Fawcett's famous circus.
So your mother used to actually tie the children to a fence.
Oh, yes, I don't know where. I think it was only just little. She made it out of a rope. She had three children tied with this rope, but she said, it was a matter of life and death, like with the horses.
Right. Martha, thank you. We'll have that image in our heads after today. Thank you for that, Martha. I have to take my last break, Martha. Thanks very much for that.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're almost out of time now. On sound today, we had Chris O'Connor. Our broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. On research today was Claire Eustace. And today's programme was produced by Dave Sherry. To finish the show today, we're going to play out on a bit of Micheál Ó Maith-Chertaig, like you have probably never heard him before. It's a recording that Micheál did for RT Radio 1 many years ago of that Prince song, of course made famous by our own Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares to You. Ní bheag ar le head a rí seán. And nothing compares to Micheál.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep all day since you took your love away. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want. I can see whomever I choose. I can eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant. But nothing, I said nothing, can take away those blues. 'Cause nothing compares to you. It's been so lonely without you here, like a bird without a song. Nothing can stop those lonely tears from falling. Tell me, baby, where did I go wrong? I could put my arms round every girl I see, but they'd only remind me of you. I went to the doctor. Guess what he told me? Guess what he told me? He said, boy, you better try to have fun, no matter what you do. But he's a fool, an amadáin. 'Cause nothing compares to you. All the flowers that you planted, mother, in the backyard, all died when you went away. I know that living with you was sometimes hard, but I'm willing to give it another try. Nothing compares to you.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Step into summer with our new curtain designs and colours. Explore our latest designs in store or online.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.